Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing, and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org. This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Democrats are now one seat away from controlling the Senate. Reverend Raphael Warnock has defeated incumbent Republican Kelly Loeffler in a closely watched runoff in Georgia. That makes him Georgia's first black senator and just the second black American since Reconstruction to win a Senate seat in the South. The other runoff race in that state between Democrat John Ossoff and incumbent Republican David Perdue is still too close to call. Today is also the day Congress meets to confirm President-elect Joe Biden's Electoral College win. It's the last step in cementing the transition of power. But President Donald Trump still won't concede, and in a symbolic move, some Republican senators say they will formally object to Biden's win. So what does all this mean for the future of the Senate and for the Biden administration? Joining us to talk about it is Amanda Becker. She's the Washington correspondent for The 19th. That's a nonprofit newsroom reporting on gender, politics and policy. Amanda, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
And with us from Georgia is Andra Gillespie. She's a political science professor and director of the James Weldon Johnson Institute at Emory University. Andra, glad to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Amanda, here's part of what Reverend Warnock told his supporters.
And my mother, who as a teenager growing up in Waycross, Georgia, used to pick somebody else's cotton. But the other day, because this is America, the 82-year-old hands that used to pick somebody else's cotton went to the polls and picked her youngest son to be a United States senator. We were told that we couldn't win this election, but tonight we prove that with hope, hard work, and the people by our side, anything is possible.
Amanda, walk us through what Warnock's win means for control of the Senate.
Yeah, so we are still waiting. Not everywhere has called the second race. So we don't know yet kind of what the final breakdown will be. As of right now, it would either be Republicans holding a one seat margin for control, or it could be split 50-50 evenly, depending on what happens in the Perdue-Ossoff race. But Warnock's win last night was truly historic for the country and for Georgia in particular. He will be the first Democrat from Georgia in more than a decade to serve in the Senate. He will be the first black senator from Georgia. And, you know, this is a state with kind of historic levels of voter suppression. That is one of the things that Stacey Abrams worked so hard to reverse. So, you know, Warnock's win and the importance of it and the historic making aspect of it can really not be understated.
And where are we with the other runoff election?
So, you know, right now, Ossoff is a little bit ahead. He has pulled ahead of David Perdue, who is a first-term Republican who was vying for his second term. Some places have called that. Other places haven't. But it is looking pretty good for John Ossoff. And every expert, the one thing they agreed on heading into this, whether I was talking to academics or Democrats or Republicans, is that at this point in this special election, the candidates' fates were pretty tied. On both sides, you saw them doing joint campaign events, and everyone seemed to be basically in agreement that both races were likely to go one way or the other, and there was very little incentive for mass ticket splitting amongst these runoff voters.
Well, Andra, at the same time, we got this tweet from Joe who says, one question that should be asked is why the level of split ticket voting. Last update I saw, Warnock received roughly 19,000 more votes than Ossoff. I expected the two Democrats to have a vote differential much closer than that. Your thoughts?
Well, 19,000 votes out of, you know, 4.4 million cast is actually still really, really small. You know, I've looked at the county returns, and Ossoff does a little better a little worse than Warnock in many counties. And it seems to be that, you know, Warnock was just able to pick up a few more votes. It's so granular at this point that it's going to be really difficult for us to figure out exactly why Warnock was able to pick up more votes than Ossoff did. Lots of survey data probably isn't going to be able to capture it just because it's really granular. But at the end of the day, the overwhelming majority of people who cast ballots for one Democratic candidate cast it for the other Democratic candidate, and vice versa.
What did we see in terms of turnout, Andra? How much of what we've seen so far was early voting?
So early voting certainly was a lot of it. So about 3 million people had cast their ballots before Election Day. And then, you know, the current vote count is about 4.4 million votes. And so, you know, they're still going to be counting some absentee ballots that, you know, came in late. But that's astounding turnout. So just under 5 million people cast ballots in the November election. We expect a drop off. We expect a much more significant drop off for a runoff election. These vote tallies are actually better than the turnout in the 2018 midterm elections. So Georgia voters came out in force to register their preferences for these candidates.
And what do you think was driving that enthusiasm?
Well, a number of things. One, there are clear contrasts between the candidates. Our country is in a state of crisis, so people have a vested interest in the outcome of the election. And then also, we cannot underestimate the importance of mobilization. When people ask other people to turn out to vote, it increases their likelihood of turning out. And what we saw was that the campaigns had unlimited resources to go make sure that they asked people to turn out to vote. So we were not hurting for personal text messages, for personal phone calls, from personal visits to our house to remind us to vote. And these bear out what political scientists have known for two decades now, which is that if you ask people to turn out to vote, they turn out.
Well, we've gotten some messages about Stacey Abrams. Melissa wrote on Facebook, "Stacey Abrams is an amazing leader who heaved Warnock over the finish line, and Ossoff may also get dragged over on coattails." And Pat in Michigan says, "Congratulations to Stacey Abrams and all those who work hard against voter suppression. Also, congrats to Georgia Republican Secretary of State. Fair elections must be a hallmark of our democracy." Amanda, give us a sense of the mobilization effort on the ground, really from both sides.
So Democrats were very organized heading into this. I mean, this hasn't been just about this election for them. I mean, people like Stacey Abrams and LaTosha Brown with Black Voters Matter have been working for years now, just, you know, not just the past couple months, to organize voters and turn out voters that hadn't voted before. And they were wildly successful. I mean, Georgia in November went blue on a presidential level for the first time in many years. You know, obviously, I just said, you know, Raphael Warnock will be the first Democrat in quite some time. And, you know, they were wildly successful, and they kept that up during these 2 months between the presidential election and the runoff elections. Now, on the other side, you had state-level Republicans working to turn out the vote, but you also had the president repeatedly, on a daily basis, questioning the outcome of the 2020 election, saying he didn't really lose when there's no evidence of that, and questioning Georgia specifically. So the message that Georgia voters were getting from the president right up until they voted was that potentially they had been cheated in November. And I don't see how that is a message that will energize your voters to get out there and vote again if they think it doesn't matter. And I think that that really hurt Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue.
And Andra, just remind us of the pressure on Georgia election officials during this runoff.
Well, the pressure was unprecedented. You know, Donald Trump is still litigating the November 3rd election results. So, you know, instead of being able to have time to, you know, devote full attention to preparation for the runoff, the Secretary of State's office has had to do multiple recounts. And so I'm including the audits and the recounts there. And they are fielding lawsuits from the Trump campaign and its allies, you know, about allegations of of voter fraud. Secretary of State's office and the Georgia Bureau of Investigations have had to, you know, investigate claims. And then once they release the results of those investigations, they are still being questioned by the Trump campaign, who doesn't want to believe the results of the investigation if they don't come out favorably towards them. So, I mean, there's been a lot of pressure. In addition to that, you know, it's not just Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, it's also Governor Brian Kemp. So Brian Kemp, who appointed Kelly Loeffler to replace Johnny Isakson, has been publicly attacked by President Trump. I mean, on Monday, when President Trump was at a rally in Georgia, aside from spending more time talking about his own election than Kelly Loeffler's election, he openly attacked Brian Kemp and Brad Raffensperger and said that he would be supporting primary challenges against them. So this has been a very fraught time in Republican Party politics in the state.
We've got just about a minute left here, Andra, and I'm curious to hear from you whether we can now call Georgia a swing state. There's been a lot of talk about Georgia turning purple. Your thoughts?
I think it's purple. Yeah, I would caution people saying that Georgia is blue. There was a third race on the ballot for the Public Service Commission, which sets utility rates, and there the Republican candidate won. And so I think that that's the new normal in Georgia. We're going to see really close margins, and we're also going to see Democrats and Republicans split victories in statewide elections.
Amanda, really briefly, what are your big takeaways from these races? What can the various campaigns learn?
I think the biggest takeaway for me at this point is that it's on the ground organizing that really works. It's not necessarily, you know, millions and millions of dollars from out of state to fund ads. And that's why you saw some races turn out very differently than others this year for Democrats.
Madeline, a Cobb County voter, tells us, I was in and out within 10 minutes, but my polling place was not COVID friendly at all. There was no physical distancing set up, and many poll workers as well as voters were not wearing masks. I'm glad voting was fast, but it did not feel safe, and I should have gotten a mail-in ballot. I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Life Kit is rethinking New Year's resolutions. All this January, we're thinking about both really big and really small changes. If you're wanting to change up your life and start fresh, we've got you covered. If you're looking to just make your home a little nicer, we got you there too. Listen now to the Life Kit podcast from NPR.
This is 1A. We're discussing the future of the Senate. Let's add one more voice to the conversation. David Becker is the executive director of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. He's also an election law contributor to CBS News. David, welcome back to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
David, there was a lot of commotion about the voting process in Georgia. Overall, how well did the election itself go?
Well, on a 10-point scale, I'd probably give it about a 15. It was an amazingly smooth election, considering the challenges facing election officials. Not only do we have the pandemic going on, but we have to remember that election officials in Georgia have been in a nonstop election mode for about a year, with primaries postponed and rescheduled, state primaries, the general election, of course, counts and recounts, and then under the incredible stress of threats, including death threats, that many have experienced. And despite all of that, as was mentioned in the earlier segment, we had about 4.4 million people vote in this runoff election. That was about double the previous record for a runoff election in Georgia, and was about 500,000 short of the record turnout that it was experienced in November. And I think importantly, for those of us that were probably all watching the returns coming in late last night, they had counted about 4.3 million of those ballots before midnight. That's just remarkable. Really think about that in a pandemic environment after these people have gotten very little rest and have been criticized by the president and others. They were able to achieve that level of participation and transparency. So it was an absolute success.
There will likely be challenges to the results and calls for recounts, though at this point, the Warnock victory is outside of the margin to trigger an automatic recount. But when will these results be certified and final?
So the counties have a regulatory responsibility to report their county certified results on January 15th, by January 15th, and the state will certify their results by January 22nd, and that's 2 days, obviously, after the inauguration. So we will have, hopefully, some finality at that point.
We got this email from Larry, who says, why don't you guys actually do a story on voter fraud rather than dismissing it? And David, again, these are allegations the president has continued to talk about post the November election. But what can you tell us about the presence of voter fraud or lack thereof?
So we could do a story on voter fraud, and there's certainly been a lot of speculation about that. But it'd be a very short story, because voter fraud has been investigated extensively over the past several decades. I was at the Department of Justice when it was being investigated by the Bush DOJ. It's been investigated by Republican and Democratic secretaries of state. It's been investigated by the president's own Election Integrity Commission. And all of them found exactly the same thing, which is that they could find no evidence of any kind of extensive voter fraud, and in fact found evidence that voter fraud, while not zero, was very close to zero. It was extremely rare. And there would be evidence. I mean, there's evidence from voter lists that can be reviewed. There's evidence from looking at ballots. I think a great example is look at the audit of all of the absentee ballot envelopes in Georgia that they did in Cobb County recently. And they looked at thousands of absentee ballot envelopes. And of those thousands, they were 99.99% accurate, only finding two ballots that had minor problems that were not fraud. They were actually cast by the right voter, but they had some deficiency that should have been cured.
Well, since his Electoral College loss to Biden in Georgia, President Trump has constantly attacked the Republican officials in charge of Georgia's voting infrastructure. Gabriel Sterling is a top Republican elections administrator in the state, and he said that kind of rhetoric makes a difference.
This is a personal opinion that'll fall squarely on the shoulders of President Trump and his actions since November 3rd. Well, when you tell people your vote doesn't count, it's been stolen, and people start to believe that, and then you go to the two senators and tell them to ask the Secretary of State to resign and trigger a civil war inside the Republican Party, we need Republicans to unite. All of that stems from his decision-making since the November 3rd election.
Amanda, we have to talk about President Trump's political influence in these races and acknowledging that there's still one of the two Senate races to call. How do you think that's played out for these two Republican candidates?
Even before we started seeing these results, Republicans would tell me, some publicly, some privately, that the president was a massive liability for these Republican senators heading into this runoff race. And, you know, as I said earlier, he has spent the past 2 months questioning Georgia's election result. He has insulted the Republican officials in the state, both who work on voting and on other things. He has called the Secretary of State an enemy of the people. He called the governor a Republican in name only. He has mocked the governor's lieutenant as a puppet. These things do not strengthen the Republican Party in Georgia. At every turn, President Trump has said and done things that have only divided Republicans in Georgia and made the jobs of those running for office in that party a lot more difficult from, you know, the perspectives of almost everyone who I've talked to over the past couple months.
What do you think these results tell us about where the GOP stands without Trump at the top of the ticket?
I think that this really shows that Republicans are going to have to figure out whether it is time for them to leave Trump behind as he leaves the White House, or whether they're going to continue to make space in the party for him to be a major figurehead. And if he continues to do that, how they're going to balance that with trying to win elections. Because I think this has shown that there are big downsides to what the president has been doing and saying, particularly as it relates to the security and integrity of our elections. And we're seeing that all play out this week.
Andra, we got this email from David who says, the myth that Black Lives Matter is some electoral ball and chain has been dispensed with. The Democratic candidates presented their brand without embarrassment. What lessons do you think are here for Democratic candidates moving forward?
I think a big lesson of this is you have to focus on campaigning in African-American communities. Joe Biden won Georgia despite the fact that Black turnout was a little bit lower than it should have been relative to the proportion of Black voters who are in the electorate. Based on the early voting counts, I don't know what the election day count looks like. Black voters turned out at a rate that was actually slightly higher than their proportion in the electorate, and they voted more than 90% for the Democratic candidates. So in Georgia, where Blacks make make up a majority of Democratic voters, you have to get them to turn out to vote. You just can't assume that because they're going to vote 90% Democratic that you don't have to campaign in those communities. You're going to have to make sure that you are touching and reaching and mobilizing African Americans, Hispanic Americans, Asian Americans, and white Democrats as well in order for Democrats to be able to guarantee victory. But it's really important to not be afraid of campaigning and being seen in African American communities. And Democrats won this election in part because they, you know, were willing to go out and engage with everyone.
Andra, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We have to take a quick break, but we have more on elections and voter reactions when we return. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Does your economy seem sluggish? Are your interest rates feeling abnormally low? Your economy might be exhibiting symptoms of a once-in-a-lifetime recession. Ask your podcast provider about a twice-weekly dose of Planet Money. The economy can be perplexing. NPR's Planet Money can help.
This is 1A. David, Trump has tried to pressure a number of people to help him overturn Joe Biden's electoral win. Clear this up for us, David. What role will Vice President Pence play today, and what power does he have in the process?
The vice president's role in this process is entirely ceremonial. He acts as essentially a master of ceremonies, kind of similar to an Oscars host. That's the only role he plays. If, as president of the Senate, there's the possibility he can break a tie-breaking vote on an objection. If that happens, that will not happen. There is no secret way that the Constitution allows the vice president alone to anoint a president in contravention of the will of the people. It makes me laugh just to hear myself say that out loud, as if there were some kind of, national treasure secret cheat code that could be found in invisible ink on the Constitution that somehow Vice President Gore missed in 2001 and Vice President Nixon missed in 1961. Mm-hmm. That just cannot happen. And I don't think it will happen. The fact is that even if it were possible, and if Vice President Pence could choose on his own volition against the will of the people in the states to send electors back, that actually doesn't lead to President Trump winning a second term. It leads to acting President Nancy Pelosi, because President Trump's term ends on January 20th because he did not receive a majority of electoral votes in the election.
Amanda, what does this mean for Vice President Pence politically?
You know, everyone will be watching him and trying to figure out the answer to the same question we've all been asking ourselves as we watch the past 4 years, which is, at what point do leaders in the Republican Party decide that their political interests and their futures no longer align with Donald Trump's? It's hard to see when that might happen, given everything that's played out over the past 4 years. You know, some senators have chosen, in particular in the Senate, not the House, to, you know, start to part ways after Trump lost in November. He still has his allies, and Vice President Mike Pence is one of them. So, you know, given that he will not affect the outcome today at all, I don't know what would be in it politically for him going forward to continue supporting the president in this effort, other than there's a group of Republicans that clearly expect Donald Trump to continue to play a large role in the party going forward.
So while it's clear the vice president can't impact the outcome of the election, David, the president seems to be under the impression that he can, or at least he's sharing that with his followers. And so, in terms of Vice President Pence's long-term political expectations, whatever he may have planned to do, there's been this threat about mobilizing Trump's base against people who stand against him. And so it seems that Mike Pence may be backed into a bit of a corner here. And I don't know. It's just interesting to think about what this means for him longer term if he has his eyes on a political future.
Yeah, I mean, it's so hard to project out what's going to happen in 4 years. I mean, I think in 2015, you know, who would have imagined that we would have been where we were just a year and a half later? I think, you know, a lot of the stories right now are revolving around how difficult a position this is for Vice President Pence. This is his job. This is part of the job description. This is something every vice president has to do, serve as president of the Senate, and this is part of that job. And this is why we have elections. Many vice presidents have had to do this. It couldn't have been easy for Vice President Gore to stand at the lectern in the House chamber in 2001 and affirm the victory of George W. Bush. It couldn't have been easy for Vice President Nixon to do the same in 1961 with regard to President-elect at that time, Kennedy. But they did it because it was their job and because they were patriots. And I think if you run for office, you're obviously, especially at this high level, you obviously have to have a thick skin. You have to be ready for what happens. And he knew this was part of his job, and I expect him to do his job today.
David, what concerns do you have about the implications this could have for future elections or our democracy overall?
Well, elections rely upon the confidence of the voters in our process. And we've had a lot of concern, people like myself and others who work in this space, people who work in the cybersecurity area, particularly after the Russian disinformation campaign in 2016, that was really targeted not so much at electing Donald Trump, but at diminishing confidence of American citizens in its form of government and in the elections that run it. And we've seen a deterioration in that confidence over time. Now we have a significant portion of one party right now with a lack of confidence, largely because they lost and they can't process that. And we as a society, and this is across the political spectrum, are having a really difficult time processing the idea that we're a very narrowly divided country and it's possible for your candidate to lose, and that doesn't mean there's anything wrong. I think one of the things that troubles me most is not only do we need voter confidence, this election was a triumph of democracy. This is one of the greatest elections we've ever held in American history. In the middle of a pandemic, with foreign interference occurring, with a president who is delegitimizing elections as it occurred, we had the highest turnout in American history in November by raw numbers and by percentage by far since women were granted the right to vote about 100 years ago. That was a huge success, particularly given the challenges. We should be celebrating that right now. It should be increasing our confidence. But unfortunately, we have a president of the United States who's delegitimizing our form of government and our elections far more effectively than Vladimir Putin even could.
Regardless of what the Constitution says and our expectations that Congress will follow through procedurally and do what they're supposed to do, there are Americans who are not accepting, will not accept these election results. And what is the path forward when there are media sources people can turn to that continue to validate that belief?
Yeah, I think that's the real question here. I don't have an easy answer. What I can tell you is the damage that is occurring before our eyes, instigated by several members of the United States Congress, that is going to require long-term solutions. It is not going to be solved overnight. It is damage that is going to require long-term discussion about issues related to disinformation, issues related to social media, and even issues related to mental health. And I don't think anyone has a very quick answer for this, but we no longer agree on a common set of facts, a common reality, and that is a big problem when we're trying to govern a democracy.
Rick in Gwinnett County, Georgia, emails, "I consider myself a moderately conservative Republican. For the first time in my life, I punched a D at the top of the ticket and was persuadable to do so for the Senate runoffs. Enough has not been made about the utter revulsion for voters like me of the actions of President Trump. Enough is enough. It's time to move on." And Ben tweets, "I respectfully disagree with your guest's opinion that no party is a monolith. The Republican Party has voted in lockstep with President Trump. Moderates like Susan Collins and Mitt Romney have rarely deviated from their Republican colleagues, including SCOTUS nominations." And Amanda, as you think about the next at least 2 years for Republicans, Are they at a bit of a crossroads here? We know that Joe Biden, post his electoral win, has said a lot about trying to work across the aisle, trying to take a bipartisan approach to governing. The GOP party, are they on board with that?
I think if you're a Republican in Congress right now and you are not amenable to taking a good look at what has happened over the past couple of years and what should happen going forward, then you are setting yourself up for more failure. And I say more because they no longer control the House. They lost that in 2018. We are now looking at the possibility where they will barely control the Senate and more likely maybe evenly divided, which essentially hands control to Democrats because Vice President-elect Kamala Harris would be the tiebreaker. You don't want to be in a position where your party doesn't control either House of Congress or the White House. So if they want to go back to winning and figure out how to get their representatives into government, they do need to figure out a different way, I think. And, you know, Joe Biden has given them an opening to do that, to talk. I don't know if that's the answer for them, but what they are doing right now doesn't seem to be working.
David, we get another procedural question from Bob, who tweeted, if one party had a majority in both the House and Senate, and another party's presidential candidate wins the election, could the majority party in Congress reject the electors and declare their candidate president?
So it's hypothetically possible that that might be a gray area within the Electoral Count Act. I just want to stress, and by the way, I should say we should definitely look at the Electoral Count Act and other areas in which we can improve the overall electoral system to boost voter confidence. We're doing a very good job. This is the most secure and transparent election in history, but there's always areas to improve. But that being said, I also want to stress, I get this a lot, the hypotheticals, people worried about the erosion of our democracy, and understandably so. But I don't think we should rest on hypotheticals too much. I don't think we should dwell on them. The fact is that this election was run very well, and we should be grateful for that. Election officials of both parties achieved that. The courts have held up. Trump and his allies' losses, as they failed to make any viable claims in court, have piled up in a way that we've never seen before in American history. They've lost over 60 cases before federal and state judges, Republican and liberal and Democratic judges, even Trump-appointed judges.
But David, so, I have to say, and it's something we've heard a lot from people who tune into 1A, there was so much fear that those structures would not hold up. And what does it say to you about the state of our democracy that people were so fearful that the courts wouldn't hold up, that our electoral system wouldn't hold up?
I think it speaks to knowing that this particular president did not appear to be anchored to any kind of reality or set of principles and was likely to do anything, and that the members of his party were largely complicit and allowed him to do what he was going to do. So I think a lot of people understandably were never sure what he was going to do. And I think there's a valid point there with regard to things like the Electoral Count Act and some of the election procedures in the states with regard to certification, for instance, that make it appear as if there might be too much discretion in there to allow someone who's truly unscrupulous to take advantage of the system. And I think we should take a good look at that. But I do want to stress, there were patriots of both parties throughout this process. Election officials in the states, in the counties, people on elections boards of both parties who knew what was right, and America's democracy ultimately was held.
So after today's formal certification, the only thing left to complete the transition is President-elect Biden's inauguration, right?
That's correct.
All right, that's David Becker. He's the executive director of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. He's also an election law contributor to CBS News. Also with us, Amanda Becker, Washington correspondent for the 19th. That's a nonprofit newsroom reporting on gender, politics, and policy. David, Amanda, thanks to you both. Today's conversation was produced by Amanda Williams. It was edited by Barb Anguiano. You can learn more about them and the rest of the team online at the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.